Well, thank you all for coming out this evening. I'm Clint McCown. I will be the opening act here. And this first poem, I've got a couple of daughters, and it occurred to me that I wanted to figure out, you know, they never listened to me their entire lives, and I thought, what is it I really would like to say to them? They both live on the West Coast now. And so this is called A Note to My Daughters, Far Away. The heat of the afternoon has eased into the gray haze of evening. The oak tree, with its broad city of leaves, stands still as the earth beneath it. Time slows, as it always does for the solitary watcher. Were I not here, time might falter altogether. As it is, my faint shadow in the fading light will soon be gone. Oh, my daughters, for you I wish nothing too steep, too far, too difficult to hold. Given sad choices, I would wish you doubt before I would wish you pain. I would wish you pain before I would wish you loneliness. I would never wish you fear, that inmost cave where souls lose sight of everything. I've wandered there for more eternities than I can count, yet still believe there is a lighted pathway back. Longing is unavoidable, so live with it as best you can. Let it be an ally, the hunger that propels the hunt. In every case, maintain a celebration. Remember some bright pool, some dance of light through leaves, some spread of color from a sinking sun. The dark descends only to remind us existence was a long shot at best, but luck was with us. Let all complaints be feathers. For 10 or 12 years, I lived on a horse farm. My wife is a horse professional, and we lived way down at the bottom of Amelia County. And much of this book, Total Balance Farm, is about that life. And this is a poem about something that happened one day. It's called Sarah Unbroken. My wife, Dawn, a natural caretaker, found a car-struck fawn by the roadside and brought it home. A doubtful rescue from the start. She laid it in a stall bedded with fresh sawdust and set food and water within its reach. It never drank or fed. Our soft voices were no balm for its broken back, and nothing ever calmed its panic into rest. Nevertheless, we named her. That ancient human habit, so prominent among our weaknesses. If need is great, some animals surrender to a soothing touch, regardless of what instinct has to say. But others don't, and this one clung to fear as if it were her only hope. She died before the week was out, the only ending possible. And we grieved as if we had an owner's right. Maybe that was empathy, or maybe just the same old hubris, left over from those first free days in Eden when naming was the only means we had to stake a claim. But either way, she was never less than wild. And nothing about her was ever really ours except her name. That artificial thread of kinship and belonging, an illusion strung between ourselves and the damage we bring daily to the world. This poem is about something I had read about in the past, something that occasionally happens in nature, and I actually witnessed it. It has to do with the way an eagle will prey upon a turtle. And this is called Eagle and Turtle. When the eagle drops the turtle from a great height, it knows what it's doing. That's how it makes a living. The turtle will land hard, preferably on rocks, and split apart, allowing easy access to the meat. But what does the turtle think of it all? Falling from the sky outstrips its understanding. As far as any turtle knows, gravity is harmless. A slow pull toward lethargy, a simple means of staying put. Shell-shattering force is a mystery of the afterlife, a puzzle inherited by blood, a secret text hidden among the picked-over remains of the fallen. In that moment of release, does the turtle think it's free to get on with its life? Is it pleased by the weightless downward rush, relieved to have slipped the grip of whatever it was that snatched it up from its sunny slant of stone on the warm bank beside the water? Is the last thing it feels a surge of joy as it accelerates headlong toward what it has known only as the safety of its home? And what if it somehow lives, landing lightly on a cushion of thick brush or slicing edgewise back into a mossy pond? What facts of the miraculous can it pass along to others of its kind when there are no others of its kind? Experience speaks a language all its own. Survivors are both blessed and cursed and have to live alone with what they know. Who among the ordinary could believe in talons from the sky, the terrifying rapture of being taken up, the ecstasy of flight, the freedom of the great fall, the shock of reuniting with the rising earth? Who among the innocent could comprehend the darkness of the turtle's dream, the one that now casts its shadow over all remaining moments in the sun? Now, this is called Elegy Against Elegies. The cold came hard, as always, shivering the trees bare. I rake the leaves and burn them. Now, after 3 days, I scoop the remnants into plastic bags and sweep the oily residue away. My hands are stained with ash. Once in the same span of days, my mother died and was buried. And each year, I think there must be something I should do. But my only ritual is the rake, the fire, the broom. There is no end to earthly disappearances. My father, too, is gone, along with all my elder kin. My own children look at me with burdens beyond childhood in their eyes. When I depart, the world will reinvent itself and mysteries will multiply. But that's not true. The mundane will hold steady. Mail will pile up briefly with my name. People will busy themselves against the fall to no effect. Time will be squandered on the rake, the fire, the broom. Birthright. When we arrive, pained and baffled, all speech is mystery. Sure, we have some basic answers in our blood, our bones, whatever DNA provides. We breathe without thinking. We generate a pulse. Consume, digest, expel. We sweat. Cleave is our first instinct. And since the mind has not yet learned to interfere, we know when to bind and when to sever. Then words take shape, for ball, for door. We cry the wish to be lifted up, the wish to be fed, the wish to be comforted. shades of meaning, cheat us out of certainty, and stutter the heart with vague directions home. Only after years of dying in cold alleys can we know that life is not a thing to be conquered, or even put into words. Birth is a passage we won't remember, and so is death, but the middle is what matters. We are more than just prisoners waiting to be let out. We are the universe asking itself a question. We are the part that wonders. And finally, a few doors down from where I lived, which basically means 3 miles, there was an ancient tiny church, and it finally lost its fight with existence. So this final poem is called Call to Worship. The old church 3 farms down the road burned to the ground. Now it's a charred scar on a small rise. Nothing left of it but history and a homeless congregation. But someone will donate a scraggly plot a few miles up the highway, and they'll rebuild. It's what we all do when day capsizes into night, when the whirlwind comes or the flood or, in this case, lightning. Even so, buildings don't matter in the end. The body is a stain upon the soul, or so they say. And at times I see the logic. Nature drives a one-sided bargain, and it's tough to know where we fit in. Deer and deer ticks flourish as much as possum and raccoon, but we're out of step, killing on impulse, like the lone cat, or worse, the pack-bound dog. At Total Balance Farm, the horses come and go, the hawk watches, the weather changes. Cobwebs, coated in stall dust, hang like silk stockings from the barn rafters. The riding ring offers up seashells after a rain, the remnants of an ancient time. I wish I could say what life is like in this place of shelter and sudden dangers, but language fails to measure up even to the ordinary. The more a word is used, the less it means. So some things we take on faith, like displaced congregants continuing the habit of prayer. Any piece of land is holy if we name it so. You think seeing is believing? Humans know the moon has no light of its own, but it still beats the darkness. Thank you.
Well, thanks to so many of you for coming here, and I'm just really thrilled to be able to read with my good friend Clint McCowan. He's been a wonderful colleague to me at 2 different universities, and you know, I love him dearly. So thank you, Clint, for that wonderful reading. And his book, Total Balance Farm, is for sale. This is a publication reading, and I'm going to read a new poem and a couple poems from this new book that's just out called For the Scribe. And I want to thank Ward and Chop Suey for hosting this. Chop Suey is a really rare and wonderful institution in Richmond. So I'm going to start with a new poem. This is written after the election. It's called Pinata. This was a holiday party, after all. Everyone a little buzzed. The department office desks and computer screens bedecked with Santas, oversized cardboard candy canes, plastic scrawny pine adorning the reception area desk with its neatly stacked chronicles of higher ed, pinned up jackets of faculty books. Imagine it, dear reader. The eggnog had been replaced by harder and more plausible fare. Ties loosened, heels removed and stowed beneath the workstations. It was Culture Studies Eddie who brought the president in, assisted by Mona Long, 18th century. Laughs from everyone. Someone said he looked like Grendel in an ill-fitting three-piece, his glower in the orange confetti hair, seething like nature show footage, sea anemones, gyrating legs of upturned beetles. They hung him by the neck, having strung extension cords from the ceiling fluorescent. The lottery to play the part of Lord High Executioner proceeds to the ACLU had been won by Carol the Medievalist, who'd taught here since the days of Nixon and Kent State. She whispered some lines from the Pardoner's Tale as the chair tied her blindfold, admonishing her not to peek. Then the Louisville Slugger. She smiled as we placed it in her hands. We spun her, and she took her reeling aim, grazing him against the shoulder, and he twisted and pendulumed, careening against the copier. Always the age demands an image, O reader, a grimace, a subterfuge, a public lie. Another swipe or two, and now the Xbox moment when the kill is nigh, the shoulder gaping open, temple parting to ooze a stream of gold-foiled chocolate coins. A direct hit now to the face, Tootsie Rolls, plastic whistles, shredded newspaper inching like larva from where the nose had been. The Cheeto-colored hair sailing down in a feeble ticker tape parade. You go, girl, squealed Lonnie the Dickinson scholar as Carol tugged off the blindfold, landing one square in his crotch. For the coup de grace, Carol changed tactics, running the bat through the center of his chest, like Plath impaling her vampire daddy. I'm sorry, reader, that the YouTube footage does not give it the proper justice. Now he was shards and wire and malted milk balls on linoleum, everyone circling the scene, the maenads of the College of Humanities and Science awakened from their ecstasies to survey the flayed, dismembered Pentheus. Plastic drink cups, mushrooms stuffed with goat cheese and fennel. Soon it would be time to pick up kids from soccer, check on mothers in assisted living. In a factory in Oaxaca, the workers are assembling the president's successors. Tina and Elena, 13 and 11, have all day glued orange confetti to the paper skulls. Marta, with a fine horsehair brush, over and over paints the scowl in feral eyes. And Manuel and Tomas, since 5 this morning, have stirred a cauldron of paper mache paste, careful to make their molds exact. A warren of basement rooms, music from a dozen radios, $2.50 a day. A buyer's being shown the wares. The president's displayed in small, medium, and grande. And Manuel and Tomas on the loading deck, stacking 200 grandes on an open pickup bed, engine idling. Now the journey north, with a burlap tarp tied snugly to protect each sneering potus from the dust and sun. The tarp, I had hoped to liken it to a burial shroud, but that, dear reader, would be yet another lie. You know who that president was, right? I think. So I wouldn't want you to get the wrong impression, though. This new book for the scribe, it's basically about two subjects that are almost the same subject. One is elegy, the other is extinction. And so poems revolve around that in a lot of ways. But with this one, I never thought I'd get all Mary Oliver and write a dog poem. But here it is. But it's also about technology. You know, the anthropologists and archaeologists discovered that dogs were probably domesticated a lot earlier than was previously thought, maybe about 30,000 BC. And there's this wonderful book called The Invaders by an anthropologist named Pat Shipman. And she argues in that book that the domestication of dogs was probably the greatest and most destructive technological invention in history. You know, she calls dogs living tools. So as soon as dogs and humans started to cooperate, and when they hunt together, they do a thing called gaze-directed hunting. Their eyes meet, and so they cooperate. And, you know, within just a few thousand years after that happened, the mammoth, the saber-toothed tiger, the mastodon, you know, the woolly rhinoceros, they were all extinct. So the poem's also got some references to other corrosive technologies, which you'll see in it. And there's one other thing in the poem. They found a graveyard, a burial ground, in the former Czech Republic from about 30,000 BC. And there's a circle of several dozen human graves, and they're surrounded by dog skulls, each of them with a little mammoth bone in its mouth. So anyway, the poem's called Canis Familiaris. Moist weeds, the wet black nose patrolling, and the noise he emits from nostril or throat I can never tell, oddly Victorian. The steam engines hiss and squeal, inching forward from Waterloo or St. Pancras. And now and then the beagle bay from his years in the hunt pack, before we found him wandering the roadsides of Prince George County, too old, dumped, and inside his ear a tattooed number faded to seven inexplicable digits, the loquacious receptors, thousands upon thousands. And Milo, three times the size of Thomas, with eyes darting, the panopticonic taking in, like a drone above Waziristan uploading terrain, the two of them collaborating only to mark, mailbox, phone pole, the neighbor's zinnias, and now and then looking up at me, not leading them so much as dragged. Such distance to have ventured from the Pleistocene steppes, windswept tundra, from our human and wolf-dog forebears, twinned packs, helixed for the hunt, with their array of inventions putting Edison and Tesla both to shame. Tooled spear point, axolotl, bone needle, sinewed thread for muckluck shawl and tunic. Together they will stalk to extinction the mammoth, the auroch, the cave bear, the Neanderthal. Yet the great invention, Shipman argues, is the fashioning of wolf to dog, the making of a living tool. Co-conspirators, corporate the Ur-Mega merger. The dual-synced pacts, weaving and worrying the straggler mammoth until she falls to a deathbed of tundra moss and the systematic rendering begins. Gaze-directed, silent hunting, permitting man and wolf-dog to stare directly at the prey's last moment of consciousness, the huge imperial eye beclouded, and the pitiless human sclera, eloquent and subtle in its witchery. The men look at the dogs look back, the outcome long foreseen. But here in the burbs, Milo and Thomas sniff and meditate upon a flattened squirrel. Above Waziristan, the coordinates are locked. A pilot in Kansas sees a house 8,000 miles distant, starburst aflame on a screen, cars overturned, a single figure writhing by a blown-off steel door. What distance have we ventured? Let us be sky gods. Let us rain our fire down, assisted by our laser-guided SAMs, our canid minions, the makers, the inventors, the fashioners of living tools. YouTube footage of Oppenheimer, grainy black and white. He tamps his pipe against the podium. The physicists have known sin, and this is a knowledge they cannot lose. The always Manichaean bewilderment. The dogs meet my eyes, tugging me home, legs lifted simultaneously against a wildly empurpled crepe myrtle. Last night, I dozed off to wolf-dog burials, book lying open by my chest. Predomosti, what is now the Czech Republic, 30,000 BP. encircling the human cemetery, a fairy ring of dog skulls, as if to guard their masters through some dim, imperiled notion of an afterlife, to sound forever their alarms, the bark and deep-throated growl, what will survive of us, appetite, some shards of DNA, and the undeserved, perplexing loyalty of living tools. Tenderly, a man is burying in permafrost a severed head, which formerly bore a name. Tenderly, he has sliced it below a collar he has woven of the softest hairs of ermine or fox. He places in the jaw a small curved mammoth bone and is stroking and stroking the rough fur of the forehead, a dead language murmured as he closes the eyes. You may have noticed my poems can go on, so this is the last one. This poem is called A Cache of Photos of the Last Ivory-Billed Woodpecker. And it was these photos of the last ivory bill, which were taken in 1937, were made by a guy named J.T. Tanner. He was photographing this last ivory bill walking up the shoulders of this companion, J.J.Q., and I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the ivory bill, but they're the most comic-looking birds. They're really beautiful, but they've got this weird crest, elongated legs, and, you know, they just look happy all the time and goofy all the time. And this last one, his name was Sunny Boy, is certainly like that. And, you know, when you think about endings, extinctions, you know, I always worry that some of the things that I treasure the most in the world are going to be meeting that same fate. So I would have shown you a picture of the second or third greatest Delta blues man at this point, Sonny Boy Williamson. There were actually two Sonny Boy Williamses. He was the second one. His real name was Rice Miller. He was huge. He was about 6'7". He looked like a human bomb. And he played he'd play the harp like no one else. But I kind of wonder, you know, 50 years from now, 100 years from now, will this great American art form, the blues, you know, still exist in people's minds? I hope it does. Okay, so a cache of photos of the last ivory-billed woodpecker. The feet, gladiator tridents creeping up the sleeve of J.J.Q., who stands implacably still. Adolescent, fearless, feathers a bristle he can afford to be clownish, ascending the summit of Q's tattered deer stalker, and there he perches, a guffawing, mohawked Buddha, bill elongate and agleam, a dazzling cigarette boat from the pleasure fleet of William Randolph Hearst, his only feature suggesting elegance. Feathers mottled, the red crest lost to Tanner's black and white brownie, eyes cartoonishly bulging. Now up Q's left shoulder, now to the back, slow crawl to the chest, where he pauses to pick the buttons of Q's Macintosh. 4,000 miles eastward, Neville Chamberlain sips tea with the Fuhrer, the treaty and a fountain pen between them, Earl Grey spilling over to the saucer as it trembles in the PM's hands. But here, the auguries of apocalypse are small in scale. Tanner sets the brownie and his light meter on a stump, and he fumbles as he bands the bird's right leg just above the starburst claw, and thus the feathered thing is also christened. He is Sunny Boy. His name is Sunny Boy, and he lifts off to be sighted once again by Tanner 2 years later, a treetop above a Louisiana swamp. The auguries of apocalypse. For instance, the Delta and Chicago blues, their steady chug and boogie towards oblivion. On a stool, on a stage, in a club in Edmonton, Alberta, 1964, sits the aging Rice Miller, a hulking human bomb, 6'4", stage name, Sonny Boy Williamson, harp raised to his lips, fingers quicksilver, ain't got but one way out, babe, and I just can't find that door, sweat and slaver nimbusing the hieratic head.
He sports a derby, purchased in London on his tour with the Yardbirds, and he loves his woman so hard the lights don't burn bright no more. Later that night, it is bourbon with Levon Helm and his Hawks, before Dylan, before the metamorphosis to the band. I would like to say they are making music, but instead, Sonny Boy pours another, spitting blood into a second cup, scarcely a year to live. Who will know him in a century, in two? Whose pulse will quicken hair on the nape of the neck, raised in awe and supplication as he growls of his beloved bringing eyesight to the blind? Oh, it's 9 below 0, and she done put me down for another man. The caterwauling harp, the amplified metallic slink, it paws the ground, baying at the moon. It flies alone, it has no offspring. It calls to its mate, who is carcass and hollow-picked bone. Glorious this last transmission, the flight in mad careening circles, alighting above the muck and ooze onto a lightning-blasted live oak, clawing up the mottled bark. And now the fervid spondees of his cry, of his here I am, Sonny Boy, Sonny Boy, Sonny Boy, Sonny Boy. Thank you.